You're going to have that one.
House Energy will please come to order. The clerk will take the roll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Bishop.
Excused.
Representative Brewster.
Here.
Representative Fielder.
Here.
Vice Chair Galloway.
Present.
Representative Green.
Excused.
Representative Harvey.
Here.
Representative Kazmaier.
Here.
Representative Kmetz.
Here.
Representative Knudsen.
Excused.
Representative Cordham.
Here.
Representative Phelan.
Here.
Vice Chair Sullivan.
Here.
Chair Zolnikov.
Here. All right, everyone, we have a quorum and we are ready to do business. The order of the bills is on the whiteboard behind me, but we are going to go ahead and start off with House Bill 876 and our good sponsors here. So with that, we will open the hearing on House Bill 876. Representative Cordham.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Test, test. Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Kelly Cordham. I represent House District 65 in North and West Bozeman. I bring to you today House Bill 876 for your consideration. House Bill 876 will create a broadband director position in the Governor's Department of Economic Development. Right now, Montana still ranks behind our neighboring states in internet access speeds and affordability. Our economy can only grow as fast as our essential infrastructure. That infrastructure needs to be efficient and well-planned. The state efforts to roll out broadband are often dealing with other competing issues. Our networks are strained right now under the burden of tourism, which is good for our economy, but not so good for our infrastructure. That also threatens our emergency services. I propose the solution is to assign an industry expert to serve for the next 5 years to help roll out our state broadband plan and use the IIJA funding to ensure that that funding does improve service and accessibility for Montanans. I believe assigning one person at the helm of this is important because they can have a high-level view and not change between years and administrations. They can have a single-minded focus on this important task of rolling out broadband for our economy and our citizens. It will provide year-to-year consistency. It will provide, very importantly, for long-term research, what the neighboring states have done that has worked and what hasn't. One thing I'm really excited is to focus on areas repeatedly missed by these grants. Madam Chair, I have a handout, if I may.
Yes, go ahead.
In a moment, you will have in your hand a map showing the rollout of the Connect MT funds that we voted on last session and where they ended up. I draw your attention to North and Eastern Montana, where there's but one or two projects. I know the population is slightly more dense out this direction, but that doesn't mean we can't be rolling out broadband to all Montanans fairly. I believe somebody in a position to do 5 years of work on this could really focus on those rural areas that are underrepresented on this here map. Other important reasons to hire broadband director is we need comprehensive maps of areas that are covered or underrepresented in the broadband world. We need a dedicated person to write and pursue grants to match federal fundings and find other avenues of paying for these rollouts. And it would be great to have a subject matter expert to serve the interim committees and inform us how best to write our policy. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I will stand for questions.
All right, we'll go ahead and open it up to proponents in the room, please.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Patrick Yawaki. That's spelled Y-A-W-A-K-I-E. Representing the Blackfeet Tribe today in support of House Bill 876. For greater effectiveness and efficiency of broadband deployment, the creation of a Montana Broadband Coordinator will help assist in ensuring all Montana communities, especially rural Montana, has the same access to quality high speed internet found in urban areas. By utilizing data, creating maps and reports on examining how Montana can have better deployment, it is a win-win. We must ensure that we connect the gap in lack of services in these communities and build the infrastructure needed to advance business in the state. It will provide the internet needed for schools, hospitals, and households for growth and prosperity. For these reasons, please support House Bill 876 with a due pass. And Madam Chair, with your approval, can I make it to another hearing?
Does anyone have any questions for Mr. Iwaki before? Nope. Okay, you are excused.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Okay, next proponent, please. Seeing no further proponents in the room and seeing none registered online, we'll go to opponents in the room. Okay, seeing none and seeing none online, we'll go to informational witnesses. Seeing none, we'll go to questions from the committee. Representative Kmetz.
Madam Chair, I have a question for the bill sponsor.
Madam Chair, Representative Kmetz.
Madam Chair, Representative, what is the goal of the broadband program? Is it every house in the state of Montana? Is that the long-range goal?
Madam Chair, Representative, that would be lovely. It's very impractical. There's a lot of different solutions we can use to get broadband in areas, especially areas with tough topography like mountain ranges. We're going to rely upon wireless a lot more there, but we still need fiber to go out to the wireless towers. So in a perfect world, yes, 100% coverage would be great. I think we should just try to keep up with the rest of the nation for now.
Thank you.
Further questions, Vice Chair Sullivan?
Thank you for the sponsor.
Madam Chair, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative. My question is about, as a member of this committee, we have heard other bills about the Communications Advisory Commission, and we passed a bill out that would continue that going, and that committee will help oversee IIJA funds going into more homes than what's displayed on this map. How is this coordinator going to collaborate with this commission?
Madam Chair, Representative, thank you for that question. One of the most exciting parts about this position is it's set for at least 5 years. That will cover multiple communication advisory councils, so they can bring that historic knowledge all the way through several administrations, hopefully, and make sure that the plan goes according to that five-year schedule, at least five-year schedule.
Further questions from the committee? Vice Chair Galloway.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for the sponsor.
Madam Chair, Vice Chair Galloway.
So, Madam Chair, good sponsor, how would this differentiate from the department that's assigned to oversee broadband development now?
Madam Chair, Vice Chair Galloway, right now the only oversight is through the now expired, I believe, ARPA Broadband Committee, and then the committee that an upcoming bill that's kind of mirrors that same bill that we passed last session. There will be a communication advisory council, and there will be the people in charge of dispersing those infrastructure funds. So I guess this would be the leader at the top of that structure to guide them.
Follow up. Madam Chair, good sponsor, but when I looked this up really quickly, and I haven't studied it out, but this is all assigned to the Department of Administration already.
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative. Yes, currently the DOA is overseeing the rollout of the ARPA funds, and then because of the natural carryover there, the IIJA funds. There is actually $5 million from those funds to pay for administration of these rollouts, and I believe there might be a clever person in the Senate who would redirect the appropriation from the general fund to that $5 million of oversight money.
Last follow-up.
Follow-up.
So in your mind, you do not feel that the department administration has a handle on what they've been assigned to do?
No. Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative. I believe this is best in the governor's Department of Economic Development because this director, he or she, will have one job, and that will be to roll out broadband. They won't have a whole bunch of competing concerns such as they have in the DOA or the DOC, which are two departments that have had this program in the past. So I want somebody with, I think we need somebody with a single-minded focus to be looking at this problem over multiple years and not over multiple crises in between.
Further questions from the committee? Representative Fielder.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Question for the sponsor.
Madam Chair, Representative Fielder.
Madam Chair, Representative, do you think that the broadband build-out in Montana would be able to continue without a coordinator in the governor's office?
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, but I do not think it will go nearly as well without somebody with that longer-term vision of just year to year.
Please, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, Representative, $750,000 seems an awful lot to we're already building out broadband in this country, in this state right now. And that's why I asked that question. If we didn't spend $750 million on this bill, would broadband still be able to be built out?
Madam Chair, Representative, I believe so, yes. But that $750,000 would not only hopefully be paid for by not something from the general fund at some point in this bill's life, but that $750,000 would pay for an industry expert, at which right now is running about $150,000 to get an industry expert in this field that really know what they're talking about and have that longer term vision. Thank you.
Further questions from the committee? Okay, I have one for the sponsor. Have you taken a look at the technical notes on the fiscal note?
Madam Chair, yes. Which one would you like to talk about?
Thank you, Representative Cordham. So I'm just reading through the technical concerns, and I was just wondering if you could. So it looks like the appropriation in the bill doesn't address the through fiscal year 2025 because of the previous section. So I was just wondering if you could comment on that and how that works.
Yes, Madam Chair, thank you for the question. I had guessed, I asked around in the industry, and I had heard that a Montana-based ISP CEO, the kind of competitive pay rate for them was $150,000 a year. It appears that the writers of the fiscal note thought it was closer to $187,500. I'm fine with that. That's just, it cuts a little bit out of the longevity of this program. However, somebody in appropriations or, again, in that other pot of money from the IIJA funding for administration could increase this amount and redirect where it came from.
Thank you. Vice Chair Galloway.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for the sponsor. Madam Chair, good sponsor. So have you discussed this with somebody in the governor's office?
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, I talked to the current director of the governor of economic affairs, and he didn't seem to mind either way where this position landed.
But they didn't follow up. But they didn't seem interested enough to send anybody to.
I didn't do a great job of warning everybody this was coming. I just kind of thought I'd see who showed up and who cared about this. And you see them right here.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Further questions from the committee? Okay, I guess I have a couple more for the sponsor. And sorry if you addressed this in your opening. I had to step out for just a second. But I'm looking at all of the duties of the broadband coordinator, and I guess I'm just wondering, how are these items being accomplished right now?
Madam Chair,
don't have this position.
Thank you. I'd say haphazardly and with no longer term vision of that 5 or 10 year plan to ensure that we roll this out in a fair way. I think we change our metrics every 2 years. We're going to have different results every 2 years. I really like the duties of the broadband director here because they kind of point to that longer term plan, the making sure everybody gets included in these funds and people don't get cut out, or they don't go just to the most dense areas, or they make sure cooperatives can be included in the competitive process of getting these grants.
Thank you. Vice Chair Sullivan.
Thank you, Madam Chair, sponsor. Madam Chair, sponsor. without this position, I guess I'm kind of piggybacking on some other comments. This is without this position, who will be focusing on this full-time in our state otherwise?
Madam Chair, Representative, that's a good question, and that's part of the reason I bring this bill, is the person that, the people that currently oversee this have a whole bunch of other jobs, and their attentions are very divided. It came from, I believe, DOC to DOA. Again, those folks have lots of responsibilities, and I think to get the best bang for our buck, we need somebody to direct this program that has both industry experience and has built networks in the past.
Vice Chair Galloway.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for the sponsor. So, Madam Chair, good sponsor, did you have any meetings with any of these folks at the Department Administration to understand who they have and what they're doing? Because on the website, it looks like they've been around the state several times with commission meetings, and just curious if you looked into where they are and what they've done.
Madam Chair, Representative, I had not met with anybody in DOA. I did watch the ARPA broadband interim committee meetings, and I have been keeping in touch with folks on the committee, but the one time I tried to chat with DOA, everybody was busy.
Further questions, Representative Harvey.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for the sponsor. Madam Chair, good sponsor, having served on Economic Affairs and dealt quite a bit with this, I'm wondering if you've had any success. Has the department or anybody you've spoken with been able to put a map in your hands that shows where the fiber is laid in the state of Montana?
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative, for that question. No. The industry is very protective of the maps of their coverage area, and building a comprehensive map proved to be a struggle long-term. We get partial ones, but I do not believe it shows the full coverage of broadband access in Montana.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good sponsor. That's the same results that we got. Nobody in the state can produce a map, so it's hard to plan when you can't see a map.
Further questions from the committee? I have one more question, and I think this is piggybacking off of Vice Chair Sullivan's question a little bit. There are other broadband bills floating around in the legislature. So I was wondering how this position would coordinate with any of those bills, Representative?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. That's a great question. I did take a look at the upcoming IIJA rollout, which is very similar to the SB 297 Connect MT Act that we ran through last time with the bidding process. It will be quite a bit different because the IIJA funding has different requirements from federal government how it's spent. I believe having this position over any of these committees we either form or recreate or redo every 2 years will bring that long-term CEO-like guidance to the process, and I believe it will just be a plug-and-play with whatever the structure looks like every 2 years, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Are there any further questions from the committee? Okay, seeing none, would you like to close?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, committee, for a good hearing. I'm very excited about broadband, and it's a big part of the reason I'm here. I just thought of it. I do believe in the bill's responsibilities of the broadband coordinator. It does mention new section 1.2 sub B, to create detailed maps of broadband coverage and speeds in order to accurately pinpoint remaining gaps. That's important not just for the long-term planning of this, but it will also help with realizing where we need more help with emergency services access. If we don't have wireless out there, then 911 won't work. Not only will this long-term planning help Montanans get access to the huge economic boom of internet, but it will also help our safety and our public safety in our communities. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. This concludes the hearing on House Bill 876. Members, we are going to stand at ease for a few moments until our Senate sponsor gets here. So House Energy is in recess. House Energy will come back to order. Our good sponsor from the Senate is here, so we will open the hearing on Senate Joint Resolution 10.
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. And it's okay to steal a good idea when you hear one. Watch me. Not my idea, but it's a good one. That's what breaching the snake dams is the beginning of shutting off the lights. But the lights are still on. The dams are still in place. We're still generating electricity in a lot of places. Nice, clean, carbon-free electricity, hydro regenerating every year, refilling the mountains with snow, creating electricity all year long. So, but some folks think there's a better idea. And that has to do with just what I'm, the bill that I'm bringing today, the resolution actually. We have an Idaho Congressman, Mike Simpson, a friend of mine, has proposed to breach the four lower Snake River dams by 2030 to restore salmon runs. Proposal included a $33.5 billion price tag to remove earthen berms to restore the river's flow and replace the power generation, transportation, and irrigation the dams provide. Montana's electric cooperatives, and I happen to have two Montana cooperatives and one Idaho cooperative in my district. Lincoln Electric at Eureka, Flathead Electric Services, Libby, and Northern Lights out of Idaho services Troy, Montana. So we're strong co-op country. The importance of hydropower to Western Montana co-ops cannot be overestimated. Along with the 428 megawatts produced at Hungry Horse Dam, of which federal statute provides co-ops first right of access for use in Western Montana, the hydropower produced in the Columbia River Basin is critical to delivery of power to more than 220,000 Montanans in the western part of the state, including the 5,000 members of my local co-op in Lincoln Electric in Eureka. Now, I understand why a lot of people are concerned about restoring salmon and steelhead runs on the Snake River. I share those concerns. However, the billions of dollars that are being invested in salmon and steelhead recovery appear to be working. Juvenile salmon production and survival has improved greatly. Carefully engineered fish ladders and turbine bypass systems have helped juvenile salmon survive at a rate of between 93 to 99% past each dam. I ask the Montana legislature to approve this resolution to express its opposition to removing the lower Snake River dams because, despite feasibility demonstrating it could result in taxpayer and ratepayer costs, the issue still is not going away. The Biden administration, Washington Governor Jay Inslee, and others continue to push for breaching. Our region is working through a challenging time as we balance the increasing demand for electricity with the decreasing supply of baseload power generation. This is not the right time to consider removing productive, clean, affordable hydroelectric dams. It is important that we take a stand, we the legislators in this 68th session. We need to express our opposition to the breaching of the lower Snake River dams and the critical power they deliver to Western Montana and other parts of the Northwest. Madam Chair, that's my open. I'll be back to close. We have a few people that I believe would like to speak up. May even be a few in opposition. I don't know. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Cuff. We will now open to proponents in the room, please.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Mark Lambrecht, LAMBRECHT, on behalf of Montana's Electric Cooperatives Association. All of the consumer-owned electric cooperatives in western Montana are heavily dependent on the hydropower produced by dams on the Columbia River Basin system. Collectively, as the sponsor mentioned, these co-ops deliver power to more than 220,000 Montanans. The 1937 Bonneville Power Act established the Bonneville Power Administration to market the power produced at the federal dams. It also included a preference clause, which gives preference and priority in the use of electric energy to public bodies and cooperatives. This means that consumer-owned utilities, including Western Montana cooperatives, have first right to the low-cost federal power produced at federal dams along the Columbia River. And they pay all of the costs associated with generating and transmitting that electricity. On February 6, 2021, Idaho Congressman Mike Simpson proposed removing four hydroelectric dams on the Lower Snake River in southeast Washington, which are part of the Columbia River Basin system. Proponents of dam removal argue the dams prevent salmon and steelhead from returning to native spawning habitat. It's also true the four Lower Snake River dams are a vital component of BPA's low-cost, carbon-free power supply, producing an average of 1,000 megawatts of electricity, and they produce more than 2,600 megawatts of electricity when it's needed most to meet high-demand periods of time, such as when there's a cold snap or a heat wave. This figure represents a quarter of the Columbia River Power System's reserve holding capacity. More than 800,000 Northwest businesses, industries, households, farms, and ranches, including in western Montana, depend on this electricity supply. Montana's electric cooperatives ask the Montana legislature to oppose any efforts to breach the Lower Snake River dams for the following reasons. Number one, power reliability. Removing the dams would decrease availability of carbon-free baseload electricity in the region, impacting reliability and increasing the likelihood of blackouts, and devastate the economies of communities in the region that depend on affordable, reliable power. Carbon-free hydropower is by far the most reliable of renewable energy resources. This is especially important in a state like Montana, which can experience extended periods of cold weather, creating a demand for power which intermittent sources of renewable generation are not always able to meet. The Northwest region is in the midst of efforts to replace carbon sources of electricity with renewable sources such as wind and solar. In order to ensure there is always enough generation online to meet the expected demand of 100 gigawatts by 2045, increasing the importance of having dispatchable baseload hydro generation. Washington Senator Patty Murray and Governor Jay Inslee initiated a feasibility study in 2021, which concluded in its August 22 report that dam breaching was not feasible at this time, given unavoidable impacts to electricity supply and irrigation. Number two, cost to taxpayers and ratepayers. Last July, the Biden administration released two reports arguing that removing dams on the Lower Snake River may be necessary to restore salmon runs to historic levels, and that replacing their energy production would cost between $11 and $19 billion. The costs of dam removal would also be significant for Pacific Northwest communities and businesses who would have to pay almost $700 million a year to replace their carbon-free output and not have a single additional megawatt to meet growing electrical demand. This enormous cost would also have no benefit of greenhouse gas reduction. Further, the cost of replacing the power output does not include the cost of actually removing the dams or their non-power benefits such as transportation, irrigation, flood control, and recreation. Investments in salmon and steelhead recovery are working. Since 2000, nearly $2 billion has been spent investing in the Lower Snake River dams to enhance salmon survival. These upgrades were built to facilitate fish passage and actually achieve spring juvenile survival at 96% and summer migrating fish survival at 93%, meeting or exceeding performance standards. Much of these investments come directly from Montana ratepayers, despite the fact that we have no anadromous fish in our state. Just since 1980, customers of the Bonneville Power Administration have funded close to $16 billion in fish technologies. Nearly $1 billion of that has come from Montana ratepayers. And this issue is not going away, which is why Montana's electric cooperatives are here asking the Montana legislature to express its opposition to breaching. Despite the conclusions of cost and feasibility studies, the White House Council on Environmental Quality continues to hold non-public settlement negotiations with stakeholders about spill and operating pool measures that would devalue the Lower Snake River dams, enhancing arguments for breaching them. In addition, Governor Inslee requested a $5 million appropriation in his 2023-2025 budget to develop a plan to replace the electric power produced by the Lower Snake River dams. And just last week, President Biden stated he would work with Congressman Simpson and Washington Senators Murray and Cantwell to bring healthy and abundant salmon runs back to the Columbia River system, indicating that this issue remains a priority for the administration. Please keep in mind, I ask you, that with this resolution, it enjoyed strong bipartisan support in the Montana Senate, and it is supported by the entire Montana congressional delegation, including Senator Tester, who has been a strong vocal leader on this issue in the United States Senate. And they all support continued operation of the Lower Snake River dams. We encourage the committee to give SJ-10 a due pass recommendation. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Lambrecht. Further proponents in the room, please.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Katie Fennigs. That's P as in Paul, F as in Frank, E-N-N-I-G-S as in Sam. And Madam Chair, I do have a handout with your permission. I'd like to...
Yes, that'd be all right. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm here today on behalf of Flathead Electric Cooperative, and thank you very much for the opportunity to discuss this important issue. Flathead Electric Cooperative is the largest electric cooperative in Montana and the second largest electric utility next to Northwestern Energy. We serve 57,000 members with 73,000 meters in the Greater Flathead Valley and Libby. Our fuel mix is over 97% carbon free, with the majority coming from the Federal Columbia River Power System. The four dams on the Lower Snake River are part of that system, and their importance in our ability to provide reliable, affordable, and carbon free power to our members cannot be overstated. They are absolutely critical. I want to go back, if you will, to December 22nd of this year, and I'm sure that many of you have not forgotten about the frigid temperatures that we were facing at that time. It was approaching 30 degrees below zero in our area, and I know many of the areas of the state all of you are from, it was colder than that even. And in fact, Flathead Electric experienced our highest system peak of 407.7 megawatts on December 22nd. Our area also experienced a very large power outage that day, and given the extreme conditions, this outage constituted an emergency situation for many of our members. Notably, many of our members questioned if this outage was caused by a shortage of power. That was a first for us. Thankfully, it was not. It was caused by an equipment failure at one of our power supplier's substations. However, there were many utilities around the nation who weren't quite as lucky during that cold snap. In fact, nine other states reported rolling blackouts on December 23rd and 24th during that cold snap. The situation did illuminate an important topic as our region wrestles with resource adequacy and transmission planning. Job one for us at Flathead Electric is keeping the lights on. And it sounds very simple, but it's becoming increasingly complex as public policy continues to squeeze the resources that we need to do just that. Our country is moving quickly toward a more expensive and less reliable power supply as we shutter thermal baseload generation sources and replace them with intermittent renewable resources that may or may not produce power when we need it. At the same time, we're rapidly increasing demand for electricity through the electrification of everything. Really, it's not just vehicles, new versions of bikes, chainsaws, snowblowers, boats, tractors, lawnmowers, all of those now require electricity. And these are not bad changes, but they are changes that need to be done carefully so that our country is not pushed to the brink every time that there's a hot or cold weather snap. The other major factor impacting our region, and the one that's magnified in the Flathead Valley, is that we are continuing to see enormous population growth. More people, of course, equals more electricity demand. And like many of the areas you all serve, Flathead is seeing incredible growth. In 2021, we installed just over 2,000 new services, and in 2022, we installed over 1,900 new services. While that growth may be slowing incrementally, it is certainly not stopping anytime soon. And for these reasons, Flathead Electric continues vehemently defending the value and the benefits that we get from the four lower Snake River dams. You've already heard that they provide a large amount of energy throughout the year. More importantly, these four dams provide significant grid supply during winter months, which is particularly important for Flathead Electric members because much of that winter peaking capacity serves western Montana and northern Idaho. I mentioned earlier that these dams are critical in us keeping the lights on, and in fact, these dams did keep our lights on during the January 2021 regional cold snap. It wasn't as cold then as it was this past December, but the low temperatures were extremely widespread across the region. And at that same time, the Chief Joseph Dam in central Washington, which is the second largest federal hydro project in the Northwest, produces about the same amount of energy as the four lower Snake River dams combined, actually. That dam had a turbine maintenance emergency. And if it had not been for the winter peaking capacity of the four lower Snake River dams, Bonneville Power Administration has stated that western Montana and northern Idaho would likely have experienced rolling blackouts during that time. The operational flexibility of the lower Snake River dams is vital in preventing blackouts during cold winter extremes in Montana. For people on the Pacific Coast, rolling blackouts might be an inconvenience. Folks might not be able to charge their cell phones or their electric vehicles, but for those of us in Montana during severe winter events, rolling blackouts can quickly become a case of life or death. So here's the bottom line when it comes to the lower Snake River dams as they exist today. They're a crucial component of BPA's resource mix, playing a vital role in maintaining system reliability and allowing the region to integrate intermittent renewables more safely. These projects are among the least cost resources in BPA's mix of resources. They contribute to keeping electric rates low for Montanans, and they cannot be replaced without significant rate increases. The federal agencies studied breaching these projects and determined that it was not a cost-effective option. And even the Murray-Inslee study recognized that dam breaching was infeasible at this time. Flathead Electric Cooperative stands in strong support of SJ-10. As the threats to these dams continue to build, it is increasingly important for Montana's elected leaders to send a message of support to help protect the lower Snake River dams and the critical resources that they are providing to Montanans. Please give SJ-10 a due pass recommendation. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Fennigs. Are there other proponents in the room?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Peggy Trenk, spelled T-R-E-N-K, and I'm here on behalf of the Treasure State Resources Association. Our membership consists of a broad coalition of business and industry, members of organized labor, agriculture, and other membership organizations, including the Montana Electrical Cooperative Association. I won't repeat any of the excellent testimony that you've already heard, other than just to express our support for SJ-10. We think it's important that because of our reliance on hydropower, Montana should be very present in any conversations about the dams and about the future of hydropower. And for that reason, we ask for your support. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Trank. Next proponent, please.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Rachel Cone, C-O-N-E, and I'm here today on behalf of the Montana Farm Bureau Federation. We also rise in support of SJ-10. We do agree with the previous proponents on our dependence for farmers and ranchers for reliable energy. Additionally, the Snake River is where a lot of agricultural commerce occurs. The agriculture products that are moved through the Snake River are not largely Montana products, but if the Snake River dams are breached and we lose out on that kind of commerce for ag products, those ag products will then begin depending on both road and rail for their commerce, which will put more stress on them, and they already are full of stress. Much of our Montana products do rely on road and rail, so if you add more stress to that, it'll impact our products as well. So we would ask for a due pass for SJ-10. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Cone. Are there further proponents?
Madam Chair, Charles Robison, that's R-O-B-I-S-O-N, here on behalf of the Montana Chamber of Commerce. Electricity is essential for business, essential for homes, essential for life in the 21st century, and we urge you to pass this resolution. Thank you.
Thank you. Seeing no further proponents, we'll go to proponents online. I have Kurt Miller.
Great. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Thank you.
Okay, great. Thank you so much. It's an honor to get to be here today. My name is Kurt Miller. It's spelled K-U-R-T, Miller, M-I-L-L-E-R. I'm the executive director for Northwest River Partners. Northwest River Partners was established in 2005 as a coalition for smart salmon recovery. And while we changed our name, we are still committed to these same principles, recovery of salmon in a smart way. We have roughly 100 members, most of whom are community-owned electric utilities, labor organizations, and agricultural groups, including cooperatives across Western Montana. Our members not only work in this region, but they also live here and care greatly for their communities and the natural environment. Their highest and strongest calling, though, is for public safety, which includes maintaining an affordable, reliable electric grid. I do want to begin my comments by applauding Senator Cuff, Montana's legislature, as well as other Montana elected leaders, including Senator Dayne, Senator Tester, Representative Zinke, Representative Rosendale, and Governor Gianforte, for all supporting the preservation of the Lower Snake River dams. Montanans are known for their common sense approach, and you recognize we simply cannot afford to lose the reliable resources like hydropower and nuclear power as the Western U.S. decarbonizes its power supply. That is because supply and demand for electricity must be perfectly balanced every second of the day. If they fall out of balance, we risk cascading blackouts across the Western U.S. and Canada, putting lives at risk. Wind and solar power are important resources, but they are intermittent. They are not always available, and they cannot meet demand on their own. And batteries are too far away from filling in the gaps. As utilities, my members are gravely concerned that a grid reliability crisis has been growing in recent years, threatening public safety, energy delivery, and costs to our communities. Extreme temperatures have created record levels of energy demand, while efforts to fight climate change have reduced our reliable supply of electricity by retiring coal and natural gas plants. Combined with efforts to electrify our other energy sources, we truly cannot afford to lose the critical, affordable, carbon-free infrastructure that the Lower Snake River dams provide. The 2022 study we commissioned was one of only two studies that examined replacing the Lower Snake River dams in the context of existing decarbonization laws. It demonstrated that losing the dams would require the region to build an additional 15,000 megawatts of renewables plus battery storage at a cost of approximately $15 billion on a net present value basis. The rate increase for customers could be 40% or more, which would gravely affect Western Montanans who get their power, from electric co-ops. Our study also showed it would set the region's decarbonization efforts back by years, adding millions of metric tons of CO2 to the atmosphere. The only studies that have shown lower costs have failed to do so in the context of existing clean energy laws. They largely ignore the challenge of running the grid on wind and solar power. Importantly, the Bonneville Power Administration conducted its own study that factored in existing clean energy laws, and it found the cost to replace the dams would actually be much higher, up to $77 billion on a net present value basis, unless there are major technological breakthroughs. We are not alone in our concern about grid reliability and public safety. Many agencies responsible for grid reliability have recently issued warnings of possible blackouts and energy shortages for the Western grid. These organizations include the Western Electricity Coordinating Council, the Northwest Power and Conservation Council, Pacific Northwest National Laboratory, the Western Power Pool, and the California System Operator. Clearly, all these organizations who are not tied to any particular outcome other than grid safety are concerned about the future of the grid. Importantly, also, breaching dams is a step in the wrong direction for fighting climate change, which is acknowledged by the scientific community as the biggest threat to salmon. A peer-reviewed 2021 analysis published by NOAA Fisheries predicted that ocean warming could result in a 90% decline of already threatened salmon populations by 2060, essentially meaning the end of Chinook populations across the region. That is, if the ocean continues to warm at its current rate. Removing the dams does nothing to help this problem. In fact, it makes it worse. Instead, it's important for us to continue to work together on better management of salmon predators, supporting ecosystem restoration in hatcheries, and addressing tributary health and other proven methods of enhancing salmon populations. Truly, the only way that removing the Lower Snake River dams makes sense is if you look at it myopically and in a vacuum. But when you take all these different factors into consideration, dam breaching is a terrible mistake, and it would be terrible for Western Montanans. We encourage you to support SJ10. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Mr. Miller. Seeing no other proponents online, we'll go to opponents in the room. Seeing none, we do have a couple opponents online. Let's start with Derek Goldman, please.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, on behalf of the Endangered Species Coalition and our 2,400 members in Montana, as well as our 500,000 members across the U.S., I'm urging you to vote no on this misguided resolution. We are involved in the effort to restore dwindling spring Chinook salmon populations in the Snake River. Removing the lower four dams on the Snake has been determined to be critical to preventing the extinction of this iconic salmon run. This is not a slippery slope and has no implications for the existence of Montana's federally owned dams. Contrary to some of the assertions in the resolution, the Lower Snake River dams are not essential to meeting the region's clean energy goals, and no analysis has concluded that. In fact, the Columbia River System's operations EIS concludes that the dams can be fully replaced by a combination of renewable resources, and that leaving the dams in place would never recover salmon and steelhead. In fact, the process of replacing these services has already begun. Pacific Corp and Puget Sound Energy have already received new bids for new energy development and storage to the tune of more than 50 times what the Lower Snake River dams produce. Clean energy resources can replace and improve the Lower Snake River dams, providing more output in the summer and winter when the power is actually needed, resulting in better year-round reliability. Although the Lower Snake River dams produce just over 900 megawatts per year on average, it's just 4% of the region's energy, and they do it with significant seasonal peaking in the spring. More than half of their total annual generation is created in April, May, and June, when the Northwest already has a vast energy surplus. Proponents are trying to scare you with talks of blackouts, but contrary to their assertions, when the dams produce the most output is when the rest of the system is also producing significant output, often in excess of consumer demand. As the Pacific Northwest region grows, demand for renewable energy could create new economic development opportunities, especially in Montana, where we rank among the top five states for wind generation potential. We should be in the game here and in the discussion, but this resolution sends the exact opposite message. Madam Chair and members of the committee, we urge a no vote on this misguided resolution. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Goldman. Next opponent is Dave Ditloff, please.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thanks so much for the opportunity to testify. My name is Dave Ditloff, D-I-T-T-L-O-F-F. I'm the Director of Conservation Partnerships for the Northern Rockies, Prairies, and Pacific region of the National Wildlife Federation, appearing today to testify against SJ-10. Failure to breach the four Snake River dams in the near future would doom salmon and steelhead in the Snake River and all of its tributaries to extirpation. Common sense kind of tells us this. Since the Snake River dams were put in, population declines of salmon and steelhead have been significant and steady. The science behind the declines points directly to the dams. In February of 2021, 68 fisheries biologists in the Pacific Northwest penned a letter to the region's congressional delegation, governors, and fisheries policymakers, methodically making the case that the dams must be breached if salmon and steelhead in the basin are to survive. And it's imperative that they do survive for a number of reasons. The first is for the fisheries themselves. Salmon and steelhead are both iconic species that symbolize Northwest as a region. If we eliminate them in the whole wide Snake Basin, the Northwest loses a big part of its identity and a cherished part of God's creation. Secondly, angling is a leading recreational activity and big business in the Snake and lower reaches of the Columbia. Commercial fishermen, outfitters and guides, tackle shops, restaurants, and hotels are dependent on it. Without salmon and steelhead, this outdoor industry would struggle to survive. I might add that a lot of Montana fishermen go to this area of the Pacific Northwest to fish for salmon and steelhead. The third reason for making salmon and steelhead survive, making sure salmon and steelhead survive, involves the obligations we owe to tribes. Fishing rights were part of the treaties that most of the tribes in the area. These tribes, you know, gave up a lot in these treaties, and it would be very bad form to let extirpation of the area's salmon and steelhead render these fishing rights useless. All this being said, the National Wildlife Federation believes that we can make almost all of the constituencies impacted by the dams whole if we work together to find solutions. We take the billions of dollars directed towards projects intended to conserve the fisheries, but they're ultimately doomed to be largely ineffective because of the dams. We could have a sizable pot of money directed towards irrigation infrastructure, modernizing rail and highways to benefit the transfer of grain, the build out of renewable energy systems, that it could include opportunities for renewable energy projects here in Montana. This type of collaboration would take time. The National Wildlife Federation isn't asking for dams to be breached now. We need to build replacement resources and do so soon. But it is possible if we start acting in a collaborative way soon. This type of win-win solution seeking has already gained momentum due to the hard work of Congressman Simpson. He held a myriad of public meetings and met with every constituency that would be impacted by the dams and set out a proposal that would provide a win-win solution for almost everybody involved. I encourage you to view this proposal at simpson.house.gov/salmon. Keeping in salmon and steelhead populations can be done in ways that keeps agriculture, transportation, and energy sectors whole. It will take hard work and input from a lot of people, but it can be done. Let's move this direction. SJ-10 moves us in the wrong direction. Please vote no. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ditloff. Next, we have Zach Waterman. Mr. Waterman, you are muted.
Gotta love Zoom. Thank you so much. And Madam Chair, members of the committee, I hope you can hear me now and appreciate the opportunity to provide brief testimony in opposition to SJ-10. My name is Zach Waterman, and I'm the Northern Rockies Conservation Director for American Rivers based in Bozeman. My organization has been involved in efforts to restore Snake River salmon and steelhead for more than two decades, and we recognize that the best available science today indicates that we must restore a free-flowing lower Snake River if we're going to have any chance of saving Snake River salmon and steelhead from extinction. Although American Rivers is strongly opposed to SJ-10 as written, for reasons I'll address in a moment, we believe and have advocated for years that measures must be in place to fully replace or improve upon the services the Lower Snake River dams provide to our region today before any dam breaching were to occur. In summary, I'd like to ask that you vote against SJ-10 because it is premised upon misinformation, mischaracterizes the state of affairs in the Columbia River system, and therefore does a disservice to all stakeholders involved. First of all, SJ-10 falsely asserts that the Lower Snake River Dam's impacts on salmon have been, quote, successfully mitigated through extensive fish and wildlife programs funded by regional ratepayers, quote. The reality is that while we've spent almost $24 billion from 1980 until now on efforts to recover Snake River salmon, making it the most expensive endangered species recovery program in history, Snake River salmon and steelhead runs are moving closer and closer to extinction. Speaking to the science of Snake River salmon recovery, just this December, the American Fisheries Society, which represents more than 7,500 fisheries professionals from around the world and resource managers, they passed a resolution on this issue that states, quote, if Snake River Basin salmon and steelhead are to be saved, then policymakers and stakeholders at all levels will need to implement appropriate processes and funding provisions to breach the four dams on the Lower Snake River, as well as implement all necessary habitat rehabilitation. While Snake River salmon issues have been mired in endless litigation, massive spending on mitigation efforts, and controversy for decades, numerous comprehensive studies have shown that it is both technically feasible as well as affordable to replace and in some instances even improve upon the energy, transportation, and irrigation benefits provided by the Lower Snake River dams today. Unfortunately, SJ 10 seems to imply that replacement cost will be cost prohibitive for replacing the energy. SJ 10 claims that it would result in a rate increase for BPA customers of about 25%. But under the most recent analysis done for the Columbia River System environmental impact statement in 2020, the analysis found that replacement costs for replacing the power would, under the preferred alternative, would only be 7 to 16%. And these cost estimates have been widely criticized for being much too high. Folks can reference some of the more technical details I've attached to my testimony. But all of this misses the point that no one is advocating for the cost of replacement to be borne by electric ratepayers. Serious legislative proposals, such as the one presented by Idaho Representative Mike Simpson, provide federal funding for the procurement of replacement power. It's also important to recognize that even without breaching the dams, the notion that these facilities will be cost effective is very far from certain. So, for example, in the Murray Inslee benefits replacement report, they found, quote, if litigation and court decisions required operational changes similar to MO4, which is the multiple use alternative in the 2020 CRSO environmental impact statement, hydropower generation across the Columbia system could decrease by 1,300 average megawatts under average water conditions and 870 average megawatts under low water conditions. That would make this alternative resulting in the largest impact on hydropower generation in the Columbia Basin of any of the alternatives considered. And this is without breaching of any dams. The reality is that change in the Lower Snake River and Columbia River system is inevitable. Mike Simpson summed it up well when he said, quote, the Northwest has been caught in an unsustainable cycle of conflicts over salmon and energy. For over 30 years, lawsuits, appeals, salmon management directives, and endless spending have prevailed, while salmon, energy, agriculture, and transportation interests continue to suffer. The concept is a proposal that breaks this cycle and seeks to deliver certainty and security to the Northwest without picking winners and losers. Proposals such as Mike Simpson's $33 billion Columbia Basin Initiative offer us an incredible opportunity to modernize our infrastructure in the Pacific Northwest, as well as address electricity transmission constraints that are limiting the development of Montana's significant renewable energy resources. Now is a critically important time for Montana to be a part of regional discussions, not sticking our head in the sand and saying there is no salmon problem and pretending that tethering our state to an increasingly expensive and uncertain status quo is accomplishing the certainty that our economy needs to see. Thank you for the opportunity to provide testimony today.
Seeing no further opponents online, we will go to informational witnesses in the room.
Hello, Chair Zolnikoff and members of the committee. My name is Kate Wilson, that's W-I-L-S-O-N, and I am the very new Montana liaison for Bonneville Power Administration. I am here today as an informational witness and as such will not take a position on the bill, but I'd be happy to answer any questions if I am able.
Thank you, Ms. Wilson. Further informational witnesses? Seeing none online, we'll go to questions from the committee. Representative Harvey.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for Ms. Wilson.
Ms. Wilson.
Madam Chair, Representative Harvey.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Ms. Wilson. We heard in testimony on this bill earlier about the reliability and affordability that Bonneville gets from these four lower dams. Can you just kind of expand on that? What part of the portfolio is brought to Bonneville from this, these dams?
Yeah, you bet. So about 87% of our energy that we market and sell comes from hydro. You can compare that in the region to about 57% or only 17% in the nation. And of that 87% hydro, the entire Columbia River system provides about 8,500 average megawatts, and the Lower Snake provides about 900, as you heard, kind of. That's the number we use. You heard 800 up to 1,000, and as much as 3,000 megawatts of peaking capacity. So that would be roughly 11%, just under it, as an average. But of course, that depends on conditions.
Further questions from the committee? Representative Kassmeyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think this is for Kurt Miller.
Kurt Miller.
Still on?
I am here.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yes.
Kurt Miller, what are the key factors contributing to the salmon decline?
Yeah, thank you so much. I mean, that is, you know, I do think it's important that we all have humility when it comes to salmon. And salmon are incredibly important. They're incredibly important to tribes and to, you know, an entire identity of Pacific Northwesterners. So I definitely am humbled by this work. And I will say that I do work with a team of member biologists who I meet with frequently to better understand these things. I think that the certainty which people often talk about salmon may be a little bit overstated. They are anadromous creatures that are incredibly complex and live through several ecosystems as they are born in the freshwater system, travel downstream, convert, essentially metamorphize, and then return 3 or 4 years later as adults to spawn in usually the same streams. So to understand exactly what the cause is difficult. I will say that that you can, and I can provide, and I'm happy to do so, data that demonstrates that since since Bonneville Dam has been built, and then also since the Lower Snake River dams have been built, that you've actually seen on a decade-by-decade basis more salmon returning to the Columbia and Snake River basins than when they were first built. And so there is improvement, but a lot of that is due to excellent hatchery work. If you were just reliant on wild salmon, what you end up seeing is something that's very common across the entire western coast of North America. And that is that ocean survival rates have diminished significantly. The Snake River Basin salmon have a smolt to adult return rate of about 1%, and maybe slightly less. And that is the same smolt to adult return rate that you're seeing across most major rivers along the entire west coast of North America, all the way up to Southeast Alaska, even when dams are not present, even in nearly pristine conditions. And so I think that when we look at that widespread nature of salmon survival declines, what we have to, you know, I think we have to come to the conclusion that there is something impacting salmon in across all these different rivers. And that is why scientists have really concluded that climate change and ocean warming is likely the single biggest factor. As a matter of fact, one of the previous folks who was testifying said, oh yeah, well, since the dams have been built, salmon have declined. Well, that ignores other things that have happened since the Lower Snake River dams were built in the 60s and 70s. One of those things was the passage of the Marine Mammal Protection Act, which essentially protected and protects and has resulted in an explosion in population of salmon predators, including sea lions and seals. And so something has to be done about seals and sea lion predators of salmon. That is a huge issue that's recognized in this region. And it, as I said, it also coincides with the timing of when salmon returns started to decline. The other is the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, that is part of the UN's effort to tackle the climate change issue. It said since the 1960s, that we've had an unabated warming of ocean temperatures. And you can track that unabated warming of ocean temperatures from then until now to what has amounted to a 67% decline, or I'm sorry, 65% decline in ocean salmon survival for salmon species, actually for Chinook salmon. So I think that, you know, while, you know, people like to point to the dams, it is much more complex than that. And I think that some of these other factors are, given the widespread nature of salmon declines, are probably more likely to be the main drivers. Thank you.
Further questions, Representative Phelan?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I got one question for Mr. Ditloff or whatever.
Mr. Ditloff?
Ditloff.
Unmuted. Chair. All right. Thank you. Apologize for that. Yes.
When were these dams built?
Mr. Ditloff?
Uncertain 70s, I'm guessing. Somewhere along that, they were each were built kind of in a different year progressively here, but I believe the bulk of them were in the 70s.
Okay. Follow-up?
Follow-up for a different person.
Okay.
I believe, I don't know if I can pronounce this name, Ms. Katie Fenning?
Ms. Fenning?
Madam Chair, Representative?
Madam Chair, Ms. Katie, I'll just use that. Your graph here shows that the Snake River dams, there's 4 square miles that they consume, and to replace that power, you'd have to have the rest of this, of this graph, I'm assuming, with windmills. Is that correct?
The chart that you're looking at represents a combination of solar, wind, and battery storage that would be required to replace the generating capacity and storage capacity of the Lower Snake River dams. Yes.
Follow up. 2 weeks ago, I went to Great Falls on a Sunday, and there had been snow from here all the way to Great Falls, and I don't know how cold it was. I don't think it was that cold, but there's 6 windmills just south of Great Falls, and they were not turning. So is that what happens when you have a windmill? They will not generate power, Madam Chair?
Madam Chair, Representative, I am not sure. I would need to defer.
We can.
If someone else in the room or online knows more about the windmills.
Does anyone else in the room want to take a stab at that question?
What about Ms. Wilson?
Ms. Wilson.
Well, I am not a windmill expert by any means and only 3 months on the job, but I can say that hydropower, as opposed to wind, is a resource capacity, whereas wind is a variable source. So you can, it's always available, hydro, and you can ramp it up or down as needed. So solar is not working if the sun doesn't shine. Obviously, you know, battery storage is an important part of that. I am sure that windmills have their own limitations as well, but I am not an expert in windmills.
Thank you.
Thank you. Vice Chair Galloway.
Thank you. I'm not sure who I would ask this question to, but I'd love it if somebody'd like to comment on how many years these dams have provided this service on and on and on a demand basis versus what's the life expectancy of a windmill or a solar farm or the life of a battery.
Ms. Wilson.
Madam Chair, Vice Chair Galloway, I could say that the dams were built between 1961 and 1977, but I cannot speak to the life of a solar or wind source.
Further questions from the committee? Representative Fielder.
Madam Chair, I'd like to respond to Representative Galloway's question if I can.
Representative Fielder, I think that would be better suited for EA.
Okay.
Thank you.
I have a question then for Mr. Ditloff, please.
Mr. Ditloff.
Madam Chair, Representative.
Madam Chair, Mr. Ditloff, associated with the hydroelectric dams on the Snake River has been a very large investment in hatcheries and wildlife mitigation for those dams. If these dams are breached with those hatcheries and lands and all those efforts towards wildlife mitigation, would those go away too?
National Wildlife Federation is supportive of the hatcheries here. They're what's providing fishing opportunity largely because the wild runs are having such a difficult time. So from our perspective, we sure hope not.
Follow up, please.
Follow up.
I'm very familiar with the dams along the Snake River and also the whole Columbia River, too. I worked extensively there. I was president of Association of Power Biologists Association. Which looked at all hydroelectric facilities, all energy sources throughout the West Coast. And there is an extensive hatchery system and wildlife mitigation program that goes along with every dam that's built along there. And this has been an investment since Rock Island Dam was originally built in 1933. And those hatcheries and wildlife mitigation programs have been sustaining a lot of fish and wildlife along the throughout the whole Columbia Basin, and it seems like if we get rid of the dams, then that would take away any obligation for those hatcheries and wildlife mitigation programs. Do you have a concern about the loss of that fish and wildlife program?
I guess it would. National Wildlife Federation is making an assumption, I think, that, you know, good conservation measures, which include breaching the dams, but include all this habitat work, include the work with the hatcheries, would continue going and not be impacted by the breaching of the dams at all. You work for conservation in every way, shape, or form.
Any further questions from the committee? Representative Kmetz.
Madam Chair, I just have a quick question for Mr. Lambrecht.
Mr. Lambrecht.
Madam Chair, Representative Kmetz.
Madam Chair, Mr. Lambrecht, I've just been looking around a little bit, and I see in 2030 the state of Washington, you will not be able to drive on their highways if your car doesn't have an electric motor in it. And as cooperatives, have you guys thought about the huge demand for electricity in the state of Washington is probably going to double in the 30s. And I just wonder if they won't require all of the electricity from the dams that currently provide your folks with electricity.
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Kmetz, you brought up an excellent question. And yes, our cooperatives think about this very serious question all the time. Certainly, you know, with a demand in the state of Washington, Oregon is following suit. California also has the same requirement for electric vehicles in their states. That's going to be a significant increase in electricity demand. At the same time, we're talking about losing baseload sources of electricity generation that are carbon free, I might add. So it is a very serious concern that we talk about, but it's a regional one that's going to put a tremendous amount of pressure on Montana, and appreciate you identifying it.
Further questions from the committee? Okay, seeing none, would the sponsor wish to close?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members of the committee. And if I might, a special thank you to Representative Paul Fiedler for giving me the clue on shutting the lights off. Because I think that was a very visible, thought-provoking little action. And I think the final question from Representative Kmetz kind of follows that line. What does happen? Where does the power come from? And many of us have had lots of exposure to potential problems as well as potential answers. But right now, we may be just a little bit early to begin pulling the plug on places that are providing a nice, carbon-free, reliable form of power. And in my world, I think it makes a lot of sense to just hold off, tap the brakes a little bit, don't start taking out the dams, because there's another part of that. There's a number of other dams that folks have made proposals on. And anyway, I think I will stop there. I think it's been a very healthy discussion. I thank all of the folks who came in and spoke up and gave us food for thought on both sides of the issue. So with that, Madam Chair, I encourage that we do push the green light, take it to the floor, I hope you do take it to the floor, and then carry it through with the green light down there. And maybe it'll come back for discussion sometime in the future. But I think we're just too darned early right now. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator. And did you have someone in mind to carry this on the House floor should it make it out of committee?
If we could talk with you a little bit later, but yes, there's been some discussion.
Okay.
So if that's okay, I'll get with you. I'm going to be here for a little while yet. So.
Sounds good.
Okay. Thank you very much.
This concludes the hearing on Senate Joint Resolution 10. All right, we'll give a moment for the room to clear out. All right. We will now open the hearing on Senate Bill 32. Senator Cuff, would you like to open on your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Could I answer your question now?
Sure.
Mr. Lambrick has talked to someone else about carrying it, and I don't know if I should say the name yet. I believe I didn't talk to him personally yet, so.
Okay.
But
we'll
he does
take care
and
of that
it's
later,
not that,
then.
I pick any one of you. You've got a good crew here. Thank you, Madam Chair. Do you, let's see, which bill did you ask me to start on, 32?
Yes, we're going to open the hearing on Senate Bill 32.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. And Senate Bill 32 has to do with amending penalties for violation of natural gas pipeline safety provisions, correction, making some adjustments. It has to do with the loss of federal funding. It's getting in step with federal standards, and you know, the federal pipeline safety programs administered by Department of Transportation Pipeline Hazardous Materials Safety Administration, PHMSA, relies on state partnerships for inspection and enforcement. In Montana, PSC is the state partner for inspections and enforcement. We receive federal grants, sizable amount of federal grants in the partnership agreement. They fund the PSC pipeline safety inspection work. The federal funding is depending on state compliance with federal law, including the civil penalties. Currently, Montana Code sets the penalty for violations of natural gas pipeline safety provisions and regulations as a function of federal law. Current law allows for penalties of not less than $100 or more than $100,000 each day in which a violation of a safety reg or provision continues. Each day is considered a separate offense subject to the penalty prescribed, except that the maximum fine may not exceed $1 million for any related series of violations. While Montana's penalty limits are set by statute, the federal limits are set by rule, and PHMSA updates those penalties periodically based on inflation. During the latest audit of the PSC Pipeline Safety Program, the federal agency noted that the PSC's authority to assess penalties has not kept up with federal rules. The fact that Montana's penalties are out of compliance was noted as a deficiency in the audit. This could jeopardize PSC federal funding in the future. To align with federal requirements, the penalty amounts in our statute need to change to not exceed $239,142 each day of the violation, So each day would still be considered a separate offense subject to the penalty prescribed. And the maximum fine may not exceed $2,391,412 for any related violation. And we can give you the code. There's more to say, but I think we have the James Brown, president of Public Service Commission, here, and he can speak with more authority than I can. So I will sit down. I'll be back for my close. I'm certainly available for questions. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Cuff. We'll open to proponents in the room, please.
Good afternoon, Madam Chairman, members of the committee. As Senator Cuff stated, I am James Brown, last name spelled B-R-O-W-N, just like the color. I presently have the honor of serving as president of the Montana Public Service Commission. I am speaking on behalf of the full commission today. I'd like to thank Senator Cuff for carrying our legislation. Obviously, I rise in support of Senate Bill 32. As noted by Senator Cuff, this bill is brought at the request of the PSC. For those that sat on ETIC, you'll remember that we discussed this bill several times during the interim period. As Senator Cuff noted, this bill was brought due to some necessity. As Senator Cuff discussed, the agency has been notified by the U.S. Department of Transportation, Pipeline and Hazardous Materials Safety Administration that because Montana state law relating to penalty for violations of natural gas pipeline safety provision and regulations are, quote, not substantially the same as federal law, that our grant funding from the feds to run the pipeline safety program here in Montana could be in some jeopardy. In November, PHMSA sent a letter to the agency that provided a deduction on Montana's underground natural storage program due to the fact that the civil penalty range was not in congruence with federal law. With the chair's permission, Chair Galloway, I would like to hand out the letter from PHMSA.
Please do.
As the agency has no power, obviously, to change a statute, we are coming to you, the legislature, to ask for your help and cooperation in updating the penalty statute to conform with federal law so that we don't lose federal funding. Pretty simple bill, more simple than the last two you probably heard, so we would just ask for the committee's support and do pass. As Senator Cuff probably noted, this did make it through ETIC without opposition, made it through the Senate committee without opposition, and then passed the Senate floor, I think 47 to 2. So not a controversial bill. I've also brought with me today a copy of the Code of Federal Regulation, which we've mentioned because that was asked for during the Senate committee, so I'll head that off. And so please give a due pass to Senate Bill 32. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Further proponents in the room? Any proponents online?
No, Mr. Chair.
We'll go to opponents in the room. Any opponents online?
No, Mr. Chair.
And we'll go to informational witnesses in the room.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Will Rosequist. Last name is spelled R-O-S-Q-U-I-S-T. I'm the Regulatory Division at the Public Service Regulatory Division Administrator at the Public Service Commission, and I'm happy to answer any questions if I can. Thank you.
Thank you. Any further informational witnesses in the room?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Joel Tierney, T-I-E-R-N-E-Y. I'm the Pipeline Safety Program Manager at the Montana Public Service Commission, and I'm here to answer any questions the committee may have. Thank you.
Thank you. Seeing no other informational witnesses in the room, we'll go to questions from the committee. Representative Kmetz.
Mr. Chair, I would like to visit with Mr. Brown for just a minute.
Mr. Brown.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kmetz.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Brown, in my school of economics, I've learned that corporations do not pay taxes. If you tax or penalize a corporation, those costs are passed on to the consumer. So if we penalize the pipeline companies more for a leak, don't we just increase the price of the product to the consumer?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kmetz, interesting question. I'll start with the regulatory answer. There is a reason why we cooperate with the federal government on pipeline safety, because the consequences of having a catastrophic failure with something to do with our pipelines would cost the average Montana citizens more than it would ever cost them to pay a pass-through for a fine to a company who doesn't follow both federal law and Montana law in regards to pipeline safety. Representative Kmetz, if that answers your question. It's a backdoor way of doing it, but it's a cost-benefit analysis, Representative Kmetz.
Any other questions? Representative Bishop.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question for Mr. Brown, if I may.
Mr. Brown, Representative Bishop.
Thank you, Mr. Brown. Mr. Chair, I'm just looking quickly at the letter from it looks like from the DOT, and the numbers in the bill are really like these very specific numbers, and yet I'm just seeing that their requirements reference $100,000 or $1 million up to $200,000 per day or $2 million. I'm wondering how you came to the numbers that are reflected in the bill.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bishop, we're putting those in line with federal regulation.
Follow up?
Quick follow up, if you don't mind. Mr. Brown, could you just show me where is that? Would that? I'm just trying to follow all the paper. I'm sorry, the onslaught of paper and trying to follow is confusing me.
Mr. Chairman,
That would be okay. Thank you. Sorry, we have a couple that don't seem to align, but now I get it. Thank you. That's all I needed. Thanks.
Yes. That's all right, Representative Bishop. We had the same question in the Senate, which is why I brought that Code of Federal Regulation.
Representative Phelan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Who for?
I'll just try this gentleman here.
President Brown.
I was going to go with Mr. Tierney, but you probably know the answer. Has there been any violations to this point? And if there has, what kind of violations are they? Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative Phelan, the answer to the first part of your question is yes, we have issued citations for violations, but the details I am going to turn over to Mr. Tierney to answer.
Redirect. Mr. Tierney.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Phelan, there was two instances when the commission has issued a fine. One was in 2011, I believe the year was. It was Energy Partners, a small propane operator in Seal Lake, Montana, where they had not followed their procedures, and there were some injuries, and we fined them $11,000. The second was in 2018 with Energy West, Montana, where we had an incident where a house exploded. There was no injuries, but there was some improper lines marked on a map that shouldn't have been there, and the commission fined them $25,000. That's the two instances that the fines have been issued.
Follow up. So, Mr. Tierney, you fined them $11,000 and $25,000. So if this goes into effect, then what would they have been fined?
They most likely, Representative, they would have been fined the same amount. These are just maximums. We there would have to be something that would be very serious in order for us to get towards that maximum. Most of the time, we have to look at what they need to do to continue to operate, you know, what their business model is, to determine how much of a fine we're going to fine them. So it would most likely have been the same amount, no matter if the maximum civil penalties were different.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions? I have one for President Brown.
Mr. Chairman.
President Brown, going back to Representative Bishop's, in the one line it's 239,142, and then I'm thinking the other line is 10 times, but those numbers aren't quite matching.
Correct. So, Mr. Chairman, so as part of my opening testimony, we are given the authority to seek penalties that are substantially similar to federal law. So we as the PSC came up with those numbers.
So quick follow-up, President Brown. But it doesn't, you weren't shooting for 10 times because there's just a number switch there and then they would match 10 times. Because it's 239,142, and then you have 2,391,412. It would have been 21.
I will defer to.
Not that it really matters, but if it did matter, I just figured we should bring it up now.
No, I appreciate
that. If it's just something that can be addressed in enrollment, they can fix it. But
Joel, did you want to address it?
Madam Chair, Vice Chair, that number that's in there is the 239,000 is the per violation. The 2.39 million is what the maximum can be on any series of violations. So the commission cannot exceed that 2.39 million. So basically, the 2 million, the 200,000, the 2 million is what the federal statute allows for. But they have a mechanism in their statute to adjust for inflation. So when the bill was first written, they were at $2.31 million, and now since this has been processing, the bill has gone up. It's like 2.57 or 257,000. So that is correct. That is the correct language that's in there.
Okay. Thank you.
You bet.
Any other questions? Good Senator, would you like to close on your bill?
Yes, I would like to close, and I think really the only thing, your questions have covered the issue quite well. I think the only thing that I might rely back is because sometimes people periodically say, well, we're just not going to do it. Feds want us to do it. We're going to push back and not do it. Well, if we don't do it, that would impact us about 250,000 in loss of federal grants in this world. So that's part of the push. Part of the push is just keeping up to date. It makes common sense. So it's a very, very easy bill to understand, to justify, and to move forward. So thank you, committee.
Thank you, Senator Cuff. And we will close hearing on Senate Bill 32. Senator, did you have somebody in mind to carry this on the floor?
Well, how about either the chair or the vice chair? No, we had not talked about it. Yeah,
we'll find somebody for you then.
No, that's fine.
Thank you.
And you might confer with Mr. Brown if he's okay. Thank you very much.
All right, we will now open the hearing on Senate Bill 33. Senator Cuff, please open on your bill.
I will open. Senate Bill 33 is also brought to you on behalf of the Department of Public or the Montana Public Service Commission, and it has to do with motor carrier regulations. Again, it's a statutory cleanup bill. It repeals obsolete and unused provisions in Montana law. I think you probably know that in the last few years, as we've brought some new faces onto the Public Service Commission, they've done major reorganizations and reviews of procedures, as well as reviews of laws, and we have encouraged them to, we being legislature. So the bill originated as a result from PSC doing this extensive review. And this past summer, Energy Telecommunications Interim Committee unanimously approved the pre-introduction of this bill at the request of PSC. No opponents during the ETIC hearings. A Class C motor carrier, and that's who we're addressing, It's a carrier that provides transportation service under a contract, charter, or agreement that establishes the price or charge for the service. Historically, Class C carriers were the original transporters of passengers and goods. Class C transportation service typically involved offloading merchandise and product from railroads and transporting it to stores, manufacturers, farms, etc., within a specific town, as well as the transportation of railroad crews and equipment to where they were needed. Essentially, what PSC deals in is monopoly private business, but monopoly kind of service in private business. With the emergence of alternatives to railroads as modes of transportation and the ability of companies to self-haul their goods, the need for regulated Class C motor carrier transportations diminished. Many retailers have their own trucks to haul from distribution warehouses to retail stores. The whole business has changed. In 1994, transportation of freight was deregulated. After that, carriers with Class C licenses issued by PSC tended to rely on their licenses to perform household goods moving, which was also regulated under the Class B service classification. Because regulation of household goods moving was repealed in 2021, last session, when Class B carriers were removed from PSC jurisdiction, it no longer makes sense to regulate household goods moving by carriers with Class C license. No need for the regulation. Jurisdiction over other uses for Class C authority has been either deregulated or federally preempted. In 2021, the Commission reached out to existing Class C motor carriers to determine whether and how those carriers were relying on their Class C license to provide transportation services. None of the carriers that responded to the PSC indicated that they had hauled under Class C authority in recent memory. So, regulation of Class C transportation service is no longer necessary to protect the public interest. Montana law should be amended to recognize that. That is my opening, Madam Chair. I'll sit down and we'll have a good questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Cuff. We'll now go to proponents in the room, please.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is James Brown, last name spelled B-R-O-W-N, just like the color. I have the pleasure of serving as president of the Montana Public Service Commission. I am here today on behalf of my colleagues on the Montana Public Service Commission. We rise in support of Senate Bill 33, and we thank Senator Cuff for carrying this legislation as well. As noted by Senator Cuff, this bill was brought at the request of the PSC. This is a simple bill, as you heard. It's a code cleanup bill. This bill originated as a result of the PSC engaging in its own mini version of the Red Tape Initiative. The PSC took about 18 months to review all the statutes and regulations under the agency's jurisdiction to determine what, if any, laws or regulations may be outdated or preempted, and we identified this one. This bill, if enacted, will strike from Montana Code state regulation of what are known as Class C motor carriers. So what are Class C motor carriers? Under Montana Code annotated 69-12-301, Class C motor carriers are all motor carriers that offer a fixed fee in exchange for transportation services. Historically, there were two types of Class C carriers. Senator Cuff did a great job walking through this, but I'll cover it again. First, Class C carriers were those carriers that used their authority to transport railroad crews and freight. However, in 1994, as Senator Cuff mentioned, regulation of freight was federally deregulated, and so therefore we no longer have jurisdiction over those type of carriers. The second type of carrier was household goods carriers, which have become the only holders of Class C licenses. As Senator Cuff noted, many household goods haulers also had Class B licenses. For those of you that were here in the 2021 session, you'll know you passed legislation to deregulate Class B carriers, which included household good carriers. So
Household good haulers no longer have to get licensed by the PSC in order to lawfully operate. Therefore, the Class C license has become obsolete, and that portion of Title 69 requiring licensure of the same is unnecessary. So what's the fiscal impact of this bill? You should have a fiscal note, which we did a good job on, by the way. That paragraph basically explains the bill extremely well. So kudos to my staff. As noted in the fiscal note, the PSC currently licenses only 8 carriers and a total of 26 basically vehicles. As Senator Cuff noted, the impact of this bill is therefore not far-reaching in terms of the number of licenses that will be deregulated. But as noted, we did reach out to the holders of the Class C licenses during the interim period and ask them if they're actually using their licenses, and they are not. So basically, this provision of law has become a nullity. So we appreciate Senator Cuff's willingness to carry this agency bill, and we urge a due pass on Senate Bill 33. Thank you, Madam Chairman, members of the committee.
Thank you. Further proponents in the room? Seeing none and seeing none online, we'll go to opponents in the room. Seeing none and seeing none online, we'll move to informational witnesses in the room.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Will Rosequist, R-O-S-Q-U-I-S-T. I'm the Regulatory Division Administrator at the Public Service Commission. Happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Seeing no informational witnesses online, we'll go to questions from the committee. All right, I'll have one for President Brown, please.
Madam Chairman.
Thank you, President Brown. My question is, at some point, it's a little late in the session, I see we have Class A motor carriers, Class D, and then Class E. Is there going to be a bill to restructure these so they are in alphabetical order once again?
Madam Chairman, that's a great question. That actually came up in the Senate hearing as well. So by way of background, so at one point in time, we had licenses labeled Class A through Class E. If this bill passes, the only licenses that will remain would be A, D, and you've heard a lot about D from that's the garbage haulers, and then E, and that would be your Uber types. So as stated in 2021, B was deregulated. This would deregulate C. We had some internal discussion about the thrust of your question during the interim period as to whether we should ask to reorganize the licenses, but we determined that those holders, particularly of Class D licenses, know that they hold Class D licenses, and there would probably be confusion if we changed the labeling of those licenses, so we think it's best to just keep A, D, and E as is.
Thank you. Further questions from the committee? Seeing none, Senator, would you like to close on your bill?
You know, I was sitting there, I was saying, hey, this is amazing. We have a public government agency here that ruled by common sense. Said, hey, if we change it, it might make sense to some pencil pusher or some attorney. But it doesn't to the guy hauling freight or the guys regulating him. So anyway, what I'd like to say in closing, this is my kind of bill. I remember back when I first ran and I was asked that in a public forum, what laws did I intend to create? And I said, I think there's too many laws now. I'd like to be able to pull a few off the books. Well, by golly, that's what this is. So this is simply cleaning up what's not necessary in the code. And I fully expect that you will move it out of here unanimously, get it down to the floor, and we'll get the code cleaned up. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee.
Thank you, Senator Cuff. This concludes the hearing on Senate Bill 33. And Senator, did you have someone in mind for your House floor sponsor? All right, Representative Fielder, you've been bestowed upon.
I am Madam Chair, I think I'm done, and I will get back. I think we're doing exec action over at City.
Right. All right, members of the committee, that concludes our hearings for today. At this time on Wednesday, I think we will only be meeting to do EA on the remaining House bills on our docket. Those, as you all know, have a deadline of Thursday, so we will meet on Wednesday to knock the rest of our House bills out. Okay, well, this is subject to change. As you can see, we're conversing up here about some potential last-minute bills. So I guess just be on the lookout, and I'll try to let everyone know what the plan is as soon as I know what the plan is. But for now, just plan on meeting here for EA on our remaining House bills. Because EA doesn't have public comment, I will we'll gavel in at, as soon as four sessions done. So we won't wait till three on Wednesday. So with that being said, is there anything else for the good of the order? Okay, seeing none, House Energy is adjourned.